So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Melissa Friedland, who's here with the EPA and our Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment here. Melissa, are you ready?
I am. Thank you, Great. Jean. Welcome, everybody, to our third Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar session. My name is Melissa Friedland. I'm the Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment at EPA headquarters. And at the beginning of each of our webinars, I usually like to take just a few minutes to talk about SRI and these CLUIN sessions. As some of you may know, SRI is celebrating its 10th anniversary next month. We found a variety of ways to use our anniversary to let folks know a little more about SRI and how far redevelopment at Superfund sites has come over the last decade. One of our efforts is this series of webinars. These sessions will run throughout 2009 and take place on the third Thursday of the month, with the exception of August. And in this series, we've been covering a variety of timely Superfund redevelopment topics, and we've been sharing reuse case studies from across the country. So upcoming sessions will continue to explore some of the challenges and opportunities of Superfund redevelopment and offer insights and stories from some of our most knowledgeable reuse champions. July's topic will be hosted by Michelle Mahoney and cover eco-revitalization at Superfund sites. So now, without any further ado, I'd like to turn things over to Mike Hancock, Gary Riley, and Tom Bloom, who'll be talking about community-based reuse planning at Superfund sites. I'm particularly excited about this topic because supporting communities working to return their Superfund sites to beneficial use is at the heart of what SRI is all about. The approach these three will be discussing has evolved out of years of on-the-ground experience and listening to how we can be most helpful, understanding what hurdles communities are facing, and thinking about how we can address them. So Tom, Gary, and Mike will discuss community-based reuse planning from their unique perspectives. Tom as a reuse coordinator in EPA's Region 5, Gary as a remedial project manager and reuse coordinator in Region 9 and currently on detail to our headquarters office, and Mike as a contractor for OSRTI or Superfund who conducts community-based reuse planning. So their varied experience should provide a valuable learning opportunity. So again, welcome, and it will all be available at the end of the presentation to help address any of your questions. So Mike?
Thanks, Melissa. I will first apologize because I am new to this technology, and I'm hoping I can manage the phone, the mouse, and my notes at the same time. I've been fortunate enough to support the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative reuse planning work with communities over the past 7 years. During that time, SRI has developed an approach to working with communities, which I will be sharing over the next 45 minutes to an hour. I will start by giving an overview of the basis for that process that SRI has developed to work with communities. We will then look at why, within the regulatory context of the Superfund program, community-based reuse planning is so valuable. Then I will share with you the major steps in the SRI process and conclude with a few key lessons learned along the way. I'd like to first start out by introducing a few acronyms, which maybe all of you are used to, but I will use frequently, and so if I introduce them first, it might be easier. SRI is the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. I also will use RPM for Remedial Project Manager, CIC for Community Involvement Coordinator, and the other acronym I'll use a lot is RAFLU for Reasonably Anticipated Future Land Use. Next slide, please. SRI provides a wide range of support to communities and EPA site teams in order to foster the beneficial reuse of sites and to ensure that the site's remedies remain protected and protective over the long term. What I will focus on today in particular is the work that SRI has done supporting community-based collaborative reuse planning. Next slide. And this is an approach that SRI has developed working with more than 58 Superfund communities in 28 states and 10 regions. And along the way at these 58 sites, RPMs, CICs, and site attorneys have all contributed to the development of the SRI approach. It's also an approach that's based upon EPA's reuse assessment guidance, EPA's 7 steps for effective public involvement, and the International Association of Public Participation's core values for public participation. And I'll talk a little bit more about each of these. Next slide. Prior to 2001, SRI provided grants to communities for reuse planning, but starting in 2002, in order to make more effective use of resources and bring a clear understanding of Superfund to the reuse planning process, as well as learn more lessons that could be leveraged across the program, SRI became more actively engaged directly with communities. The HOD landfill in Antioch, Illinois, was the first site SRI engaged directly with the community. And I won't talk about HOD very much because Tom's going to cover that site in some detail, but there is one important point to make about the HOD site. Next slide, please. The grand opening of the community athletic fields at the HOD landfill occurred on June 6, 2008. And reuse planning at this site started in early 2002. And at the time that we started, SRI started reuse planning at this site, the site was construction complete, meaning that all of the active remedial components that EPA was going to install at this site were there. So it took 6 years in a situation that many considered to be a slam dunk to get reuse outcomes at this site. And I think this underscores that the reuse planning is often about long-term stewardship on the part of communities and requires patience, which is something that SRI emphasizes with every community that we work with. It is a challenge to get people engaged in understanding the importance of thinking about reuse that may occur in 5 or 10 years. It is even more challenging to tell them that reuse planning will influence remedy decisions when you're not exactly sure when those decisions will be made or exactly when the remedy will be implemented. So lesson number one with reuse planning at Superfund sites, patience and long-term stewardship. Next slide, please. A lot of other lessons were learned at the HOD site, and since that time, SRI has engaged and supported community-based reuse planning across the country. Each site has benefited from the lessons learned at previous sites, and in turn has added to SRI's understanding of the sometimes complex dynamics involved in engaging communities and stakeholders on reuse issues at Superfund sites. And this map is a reasonably current representation of the sites where SRI has provided community-based reuse planning support. Next slide, please. I apologize because I think something is missing on this slide, but as I suggested, SRI's planning efforts at sites has been guided to some degree by the reuse assessment guidance. In 1995, EPA issued the Land Use Directive, which basically states that remediation should be based on future land uses. Then in 2002, EPA issued the Reuse Assessment Guidance, which is a methodology that to help remedial project managers, or RPMs, evaluate potential future land uses. SRI's planning approach with communities is very similar to the Reuse Assessment Guidance methodology, except that the process with SRI is to assist local communities to go through this assessment on their own, so that at the end of the process, the community can say to EPA, this is what we think the reasonably anticipated future land uses are at this site, rather than that assessment being made by EPA staff. And the result of this process is giving EPA the information it needs to make remedial decisions without EPA potentially stepping on the local prerogative to determine land uses. Next slide, please. The process is also based on EPA's 7 steps to effective public involvement, and I will just touch briefly on the critical importance of a few of these steps. The second bullet there, identify interested and affected public. SRI works very hard to identify and engage all parties who are potentially interested and affected by a site's reuse, but also recognizes that these parties may have very different standing as it relates to reuse, and SRI works hard to have all the parties understand those differences. And by standing, I mean certain parties, like perhaps a site owner, will have far greater influence on how a property will ultimately be used. But that does not mean that parties with less standing will not have a valuable contribution to make to the process. SRI, as Melissa suggested earlier, SRI's primary focus in the reuse planning process is to give communities the tools and information they need to be good and effective participants in the process, which is very consistent with EPA's public involvement goals. And finally, the provide information outreach to the public, particularly that outreach to the public, SRI takes steps to reach as broad an audience as possible when working with communities at sites. And what SRI has done on a number of occasions in order to oftentimes the reuse planning process may take 6 to 8 months, and it is hard to engage a very large group of the public over that period of time. So EPA has taken, on occasion, a two-step approach, one forming a land use committee that may be as many as 20 people, 30 people, who work through the details of a planning process. But then SRI supports that group in reaching out to the larger public and hosting larger public events in order to reach as many people as possible. In addition, also SRI also often seeks local government endorsement of the process, recognizing the local government's role in regulating land uses. Their engagement in the process can be extremely helpful. Next slide, please. So I'm on slide number 9 for reference. The community-based reuse planning process is also true to the values of the International Association of Public Participation, and I would like to touch on a few key points here. Public participation includes the promise that the public's contribution will influence the decision, and I think it's also critically important that in the process, the public understands how and when that their contribution will actually influence the decision-making process. But it's also important for them to understand the limitations on that influence so that they don't have false expectations and become disillusioned with the process. So it's important for them to understand that the remedy selection is based on balancing a set of criteria, and reuse is one consideration among many. Superfund is first and foremost about protecting human health and the environment, and must do so within the constraints of a legal and financial framework. So community-based reuse plans can greatly influence the remedy process, but they do not necessarily drive the process. And I think it's important for the public who you're engaging at these sites to understand that dynamic so that they understand how their input is influencing the process. The other dynamic is the public also needs to understand the limits imposed by property rights and real estate markets, which both can seriously limit the influence their participation may have on the final outcome. But in many cases, we see that these community-based reuse plans greatly influence the ultimate reuse of the site and oftentimes drive the site's ultimate reuse. So getting folks to understand that their input can be very influential, but that there are limits, and explaining to them what those limits are, I think, is a critical part of what SRI does and is very important to the core values of public participation. Next slide, please. The public participation process communicates to participants how their input was or was not used. And our experience is that community-based reuse planning, given the timeframes of Superfund, is often an iterative process. And as EPA moves through the pipeline of activities at the site, revisiting and revising the site's reuse plan can often be very helpful. And engaging the public in this process really helps the public understand how their participation is influencing the process and how the time that they've taken to be involved in this process has been useful. And again, the last value of public participation is all about giving the public the information they need to be good participants in the process. And that's what the SRI process is all about. Next slide, please. So I've touched a little bit on the thinking that has shaped the process, but let's talk briefly about why EPA engages the public in a community-based reuse planning. Next slide. I like the term community-based reuse assessment more than I like the term community-based planning. And as part of the remedial process, EPA must assess the reasonably anticipated future land uses at a site. The reuse assessment guidance is a good framework for thinking about future land use, but given the proper tools, local stakeholders can provide a better understanding of reasonably anticipated future land uses at a site than EPA might do on its own. And their understanding of that they gain through the process also can shape the future uses at a site in a way that makes them work better with the remedy. And through the process, local stakeholders will become better long-term stewards at the site. They will better understand how to maintain public safety and maintain public safety and health at these sites and undertake activities at the sites that will be protective of the remedies, make sure that the remedies are not damaged. So the result of this process is, again, giving EPA the information they need to make remedial with EPA stepping on local authority to determine land use. But in addition, it engages and empowers communities as partners with EPA and helps them to take control of the site's future. Next slide, please. So the short answer to why EPA engages in community-based reuse planning is better decisions. SRI works with communities to give them the tools to be good participants, and in turn, the communities provide EPA with valuable information that informs the remedial process, resulting in better remedies and a far greater opportunity that the sites will be returned to beneficial and protective uses. Next slide, please. In addition, reuse planning can produce significant additional benefits beyond better protection of human health and the environment. And one of the most rewarding moments I've had doing this work for SRI was involved Leo France in D.C. And Leo is an OSC in Region 4 who is the RPM at the Camilla Wood Treating NPL site. When we first started working with Leo, he was somewhat resistant to the SRI approach, but by the end of the process, he was a big fan. And I asked him if he thought the process was worthwhile at the end of the process, and he said, we should be doing this at every site. He said that he thought taxpayers were really demanding more outcome for their money, and that cleaning up sites without making them ready for some beneficial use was not the best use of taxpayer money. And so I think that the SRI approach to engaging community opens up this opportunity to not only have sites be more protective and have the remedies be more protected, but it also creates a series of other benefits for communities, or has the potential to create a series of other benefits, both for the agency and communities. And so I'm going to run through a few of those benefits using a few site examples. So it can save money at sites. And this is the Spelman Engineering site in Orlando, Florida. If you can see the very small orange circle kind of to the upper right corner of your slide, that is the Spelman Engineering site. And on that site, there is a little five foot by five foot area where the Spelman Engineering facility, they were cleaning parts for NASA and the Air Force, and they poured all their extra TCE into the ground in a very small area, which resulted in this very large plume, which I don't think this is the plume. It hasn't quite hit the lake yet. And so after nearly a three-year EPA dialogue with, the next slide, please, slide number 16. After a nearly three-year EPA dialogue with the community and key stakeholders, the site will avoid NPL listing as a result of a collaboration between the Orlando Utility Commission, the City of Orlando, and the Lake Highland Preparatory School, which is pictured here. And the final resolution seems to be that the Lake Highland Preparatory School will be taking responsibility to clean up the property and redevelop the site. This is an estimated $10 million cleanup being conducted by the private sector that was facilitated by a community-based dialogue on reuse by EPA. And so this is a great example of a big dollar amount that reuse planning is able to save at sites. I think it's important to point out that the majority of Superfund sites do not enjoy real estate market values that are so high that they will cover the cost of cleanup. But there are lots of little ways that money can be saved at sites along the way through effective thinking about reuse. Next slide, please. There's also the potential to save time in the process. And this is the Heimco site in Elkhart, Indiana. It's an old landfill site where Bayer Aspirin is the PRP. And the presumptive remedy for the site was to completely clear the site and install a traditional cap across the site. Next slide. By working with the community, the RPM, and Steve Rock from EPA's Cincinnati office, a reuse framework was developed that satisfied community goals, satisfied EPA's need, and left much of the existing ecosystem intact, reducing the scope and cost of the remedy. So as a result, Bayer Aspen has been a far more cooperative party in the process, and the community is going to get uses and an outcome that they want at the site, and EPA is able to move the process forward a little bit faster. Next slide, please. Plainwell, Michigan is a small city of 4,500 residents located in southwestern Michigan, adjacent to the Kalamazoo River. And I think that this is a site that really emphasizes how improve community relations both with EPA and amongst members and stakeholders in the community can result out of this process. The 36-acre Plainwell Paper Mill property is located in downtown Plainwell, part of the regional Allied Paper Portage Creek Kalamazoo River Superfund site. The paper mill property had long been a vital part of the community's economy, history, and heritage. And for more than a century prior to the facility's closure in 2000, paper mill operations were a huge employer in the area. The city of Plainwell has been a champion for cleanup and redevelopment of the Plainwell paper mill property, recognizing the community-wide benefits and potential opportunities offered by the property's location, size, and history. By turning the mill property into a productive asset once again, the city of Plainwell hopes to raise property values, enhance the city's revenue stream, and create new interest in the downtown area. Next slide. So we're on slide 20. In 2004, SRI aided the city's efforts by sponsoring a community-based reuse planning process to support remedy protectiveness and long-term stewardship of the site. For 7 months, a community-based mill committee researched the property's history, assessed local land use trends and market conditions, and developed reuse guidelines and a reuse strategy for the paper mill property. The reuse planning process established relationships between the City of Plainwell, EPA Region 5, Michigan DEQ. The project also raised the community's awareness of the significance and status of the paper mill property, enabling the City of Plainwell to build community support for the property's cleanup and redevelopment. Finally, the process established a working relationship between the City of Plainwell and Weyerhaeuser, the site's owner and potentially responsible party. The project's reuse strategy calls for a new city hall and office and retail space on the eastern portion of the site, recreational trails that extend along the Kalamazoo River, the adaptive reuse of former paper facility structures for parkland and open space, and mixed residential, commercial, and public land uses in the central portion of the site. Based on the reuse planning process, the City of Plainwell took control of the mill property in August 2006, and the city has updated the site reuse plan and is currently working to attract developers and other interested parties to help spur the site's reuse. Next slide, please. This is the Camilla Wood Treating Site in Camilla, Georgia. It's a 40-acre former wood treating facility in southwest Georgia. And I think the site represents a lot of things, but it points to how the reuse planning process can be very supportive of implementing institutional controls. This photo was taken after a major rain event and demonstrates some stormwater management issues at the site, but the site is not normally underwater. Next slide, please. SRI was originally approached by the local fire chief who wanted to use the site for a fire rescue training facility. Through an SRI effort that engaged a broad group of community stakeholders, including the city council and site neighbors, the community recognized the enormous potential of this site for a community park, and they determined that that was the highest, best, and most appropriate future use for the site, given the surrounding land uses. Next slide, please. The community has acquired the portion of the site, has since acquired the portion of the site that EPA has completed cleanup on and turned it into athletic fields. Through the process, the community came to understand the tangible benefits of working closely with EPA at this site. The benefit to EPA of the community's engagement were twofold. First, the community took title to an abandoned piece of property and took responsibility for long-term stewardship at the site. And prior to that, the EPA was very concerned about, well, we're going to put this remedy in place. There's nobody who really is interested or owns this property. How are we going to make sure that the remedy is protected and taken care of? The second benefit to EPA as a result of the strong working relationships built with the community is that the community has expressed an understanding and a willingness to help EPA implement institutional controls at the site, including a potential willingness to create local ordinances to restrict uses, such as off-site groundwater use, that might otherwise have been hard to achieve. So the institutional controls have not, I don't believe, have been finalized yet at this site, but it's a great example of the community now getting benefits out of the property, coming to understand and work with EPA in a way to protect and help local citizens. It became very clear to the community why they would step up and work with EPA and institutional controls. And I think without that kind of a dialogue, it might have been a situation in which the local community felt like EPA was dumping a problem on them that EPA didn't want to deal with. And so I think that's been a huge benefit at this site. Next slide, please. I'm on slide number 24. This is the Wyckoff Eagle Harbor site, which is on Bainbridge Island. Bainbridge Island is just off the coast of Seattle. It's a ferry boat ride from downtown Seattle. And it's another former wood treating facility. It's a creosote. They use creosote at this site, and creosote contaminated the 40-acre land parcel of this, but it also infiltrated the harbor, and was the entire floor of the harbor needs to be cleaned up. Bainbridge Island is the location of where the book and the film Snow Falling on Cedars took place, if any of you are familiar with that movie and book, and I'll come back to that in a second. Next slide, please. The SRI community-based reuse planning process at this site helped educate the community about the state's role in providing long-term operation and maintenance at this site and clarified the limits of their responsibility as potential future site owners. This dialogue paved the way for the local government acquisition of the property, which is a great outcome for long-term stewardship. Having a governmental entity that is local, that is concerned about the site and actively engaged at the property is a great thing. The eastern end of this site, which is most of the majority, 90% of the site, and it's the area that's not in the dark green on the left, is going to be turned into a public park. The dark area of the site on the far left, which is about 10% of the site, is slated for a different use. As I mentioned, Bainbridge Island is the site of the book Snow Falling on Cedars, and there was a dock on this 10-acre portion at the far left of this site that was the Eagledale Ferry Landing was the first place in the United States where Japanese Americans were sent to internment camps. So if you go to the next slide, which is slide number 27, the little boy on the far right of the picture on your upper left is the gentleman on the lower left. And the residents of Bainbridge Island have been very active. And if you go to the, so this is him at the dock getting ready to go to internment camps. And this was him, I think, in 2005 or 2006. Next slide, which is slide number 27. They're currently building at this site on the left portion a National Nikkei Memorial to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, all of which was this whole process of turning this into a park and paving the way for this to become a national monument was facilitated by a dialogue with the community that allowed the public to take ownership of this site. The next slide, to talk a little bit about economic benefits, if we look at slide number 28, slide number 28. This is the South Point, Ohio plant Superfund site. It covers 75 acres on the Ohio River at the very southern tip of Ohio. And from 1943 to 1979, Allied Chemical produced ammonia, nitrogen fertilizer, and formaldehyde at the site. And during operation, several landfills and surface impoundments were used to dispose of process waste. Next slide. The reuse planning process for the site identified opportunities for mixed commercial and industrial land uses at the site, including the reuse of some of the contaminants, the fly ash, from past site operations for roadbed materials. And the site next slide is slide number 30. Today, remediation of the site's groundwater is ongoing, and the site is in commercial and industrial reuse. Lawrence County Economic Development Corporation operates a 500-acre industrial park called The Point that includes the site. So that's a good example of an economic opportunity. There's also creates recreational opportunities for communities. This is the Arlington Blending and Packaging site. It's a small 4-acre site in the growing suburbs of Memphis. This is a site where SRI engaged community members after the remedy was complete. At this site, SRI provided a ready for reuse determination, which helped local government officials explain the site's safety to the public at large and was a great catalyst for moving the project forward. SRI also engaged, also worked with community members to develop plans for a neighborhood park that would be consistent with and protective of the site's remedy. The next slide. And today, Mary Alice Park, which was named after a local community activist, serves children from a lower-income, working-class neighborhood that previously had limited access to recreational opportunities. So an example of how reuse can produce additional recreational benefits. And finally, talk a little bit about ecological benefits that can be created. And this is the Calumet Container Facility in Hammond, Indiana. It's the site of an EPA removal action. Next slide. At this site, SRI worked with community members to determine desired future uses consistent with removal objectives on a very quick turnaround basis. I think the whole process took less than 30 days. If you go to your next slide, the site is now, it was returned. It was revegetated with native plants and has been restored to a state similar to its pre-industrial ecological condition. There's a trail through the site that provides both a recreational opportunity, a limited recreational opportunity, but it also facilitates environmental education opportunities for local students. The pictures on the left are before, and the pictures on, I'm sorry, the pictures on the left are before, and the pictures on your right are after photographs. Those are some school kids that we hired to go out for the picture, I think. I don't know how we got so lucky to get a picture when they're actually out there. But so,
That's not true, Mike.
That's not true? You didn't pay them, Tom?
Didn't pay them, no. They were stuck in school. They had to go.
So the next slide, I'm sorry, slide number 37. So I've talked a little, I think that was, I tried to give you a quick overview of the additional benefits that reuse planning, community-based reuse planning can create. I think the primary benefits are the long-term protectiveness, having local stakeholders engaged at the site for the long-term understanding how to maintain the site's protectiveness, but also to protect the remedy, a smoother process for EPA. But then there's this whole set of additional benefits that can come out of the process, which some of which benefit EPA directly, but others of which benefit the community. So now that we've talked about the philosophical underpinnings of community-based reuse planning and EPA's motivation for doing community-based reuse planning and some of the potential benefits derived from community-based reuse planning, I want to walk through a couple of the key steps that SRI has identified as being important to the process. Superfund sites have very unique characteristics and considerations from a standpoint of the size of the sites and the contamination at the sites and the political context of the site, but they also have very unique considerations as it relates to the surrounding community, different land use demands, different considerations. So the process that SRI uses at Superfund sites is adjusted to the conditions at each site, but we found kind of five major steps that I'm about to outline have proven critical at a really very broad range of these sites. And while each of these five steps isn't involved at every site, most of them are used at most sites. Next slide, please. Before I go to the five steps, I want to briefly talk about what a reuse plan looks like. And as I stated earlier, community-based reuse planning at Superfund sites works best as an iterative process. Planning early is great because it can inform the remedial investigation and feasibility study of the site. But as more information is learned during the EPA investigation, plans may need to be reworked. In addition, I think oftentimes the community needs time to absorb what they've learned about the site and get their ducks in a row, if you will, for future development, thinking about where they're going to get funding, et cetera. So most of the plans developed early in the process look something like the picture on the slide, which highlights zones for different types of uses and expresses the general intent of the plan without creating a false sense of precise detail. As you can see, we did not have detailed building footprints or pictures of proposed buildings. That level of detail in a plan is more appropriately done at a later phase in the development process, and done too early can create a false sense of how far the process is along. So closer to the time of actual development, developing a more accurate plan or a more detailed plan is appropriate, but at most of the time at the Superfund sites, I'm sorry, I just got past a note that I wasn't announcing slide changes loud enough. So I'm on slide 38. I just want to make sure that everybody is in the same place before I go on. So most of the time at a Superfund site, this is what a reuse plan looks like, particularly in the early phases of the process. Outlining, letting people understand, you know, where the remedy is, where the remedy components are, and where reuses relate to those components. Next slide, please. Slide number 39. As I suggested earlier, the reuse planning process that has been developed by SRI mirrors very much the reuse assessment guidance. So I've laid out the five major steps we see in the reuse planning process, and then I've mapped that to the reuse assessment guidance steps. And so I'm going to talk about each of these things on the right in a little bit more detail, but the first step is building stakeholder support and establishing the legitimacy of the reuse planning process. The second step is community involvement, education, and capacity building. SRI is really trying to provide community members with the tools that they need to be good participants in the process. Most members of the community bring to the table an awful lot of understanding of local issues, but they may not understand Superfund, or they may not understand local land use regulations, or they may not understand the forces that that affect future land use. So SRI is trying to give those folks the tools that they need to be good participants in the process so that they can then share with EPA in an effective way the information that they bring to the table, which is immense. The third step in the process is site and community research and analysis. The fourth step in the process, which starts to get away from the reuse assessment guidance a little bit, is creating this map or framework for the site's reuse. And then the fifth step is helping the community think about resources and implementation approaches, steps that they might need to take moving forward. Next slide, please. So building stakeholder support and establishing the legitimacy of the reuse planning process. Given the complexity of community-based reuse planning at Superfund sites, this step has proven to be very critical. Each of the stakeholders coming to the table has concerns about the process that need to be addressed, and all stakeholders need to understand both the limitations and the benefits of the process as a whole, and the benefits and the limitations to them as individuals. Key stakeholders that may have a very different perspective and concerns about the process include the RPM, the site attorney, the CIC, the state regulators, local elected officials, community members at large, folks who live in the larger community might have one set of concerns, but then site neighbors may have a different set of concerns and issues. The site owners and the PRPs also will have their concerns about the process. And so it's really important in order to create a collaborative environment, it's really important to address all of these concerns before bringing folks to the table, before you start to actually think about the details of the reuse of the site. And a couple of key topics that need to be covered to make all parties comfortable with the process. Number one is making it clear that EPA's primary goal and responsibility is to protect human health and the environment. Folks are often concerned that when we start talking about reuse of a site, they associate reuse with developers, and they associate developers with people out to make money. And there's a concern that maybe EPA is setting aside protecting the public's health. And it's very important that establish the expectation up front that is EPA's primary objective. It's also really important as you're bringing stakeholders to the table to be developing reuse plans to make it very clear that the plans created by the group really have no binding authority, and that they're not, they're only meant to serve as advisory documents to EPA, the local government, and the site owners. You want to be very, we want to be very careful not to set up a false set of expectations. So again, just coming back to something I talked about before, having the stakeholders understand that EPA has a whole a regulatory regime and a set of criteria that they need to use in order to evaluate remedy proposals, and they also have to operate within the limits of how much they can force or require responsible parties to do. They also need to understand that they also, there are very significant limits if the land is owned by a private property owner. At the end of the day, that private property owner can't be forced to reuse the property in any way inconsistent with how they want to use the property. But given those limitations, it's also important to paint for them the picture of why it's important for them to engage and the benefits of them engaging and how the very positive results that have been created in many other communities by doing this reuse planning. So that's a critical first step, is just getting all the stakeholders to understand the framework within which they're operating and get them comfortable that this process is not going to force them or bring them to a place that is going to be very uncomfortable for them. Getting site owners to understand that we're going to emphasize your rights as a private property owner, but on the other hand, you might as a landowner really benefit from hearing what the public would like to see at this site and really understanding how that might be beneficial to the remedy and protective of the remedy, those kind of things. Next slide, please. The next two steps in the SRI process really emphasize the idea of giving the community the tools they need to be better participants, both now and over the long haul. SRI's goal is to both help the community create a plan that articulates a reasonably anticipated future land use, but also build the community's capacity to be participants over the long haul and hopefully take on a role in the future of long-term stewardship. Again, reuse at Superfund sites often requires patience and a belief in the importance of long-term stewardship. These sites took decades and sometimes generations to become abandoned hazardous waste sites. It may take 5 or 10 years to turn them back into safe community assets. So it is important that we build the community's capacity to be participants and to stick with this over some period of time. We're really working on building their capacity, not giving them the answers, but trying to help them think of all the right questions and understand the context. And when we do that, EPA provides some assistance to the community in terms of this number three step in the process, site and community research and analysis. And so there are a pretty broad range of forces that will affect the site's future use. And in any given situation, some will be larger factors than others. And so the SRI tries to work with communities to identify what are the kind of the key pieces of information we need, and how do we gather that information in the most cost-effective way? We're not trying to be exhaustive. We're trying to figure out how do we gather the information we need to make good decisions in the easiest way possible. So if we'll go to the next slide, I'll just touch on some of those types of information that SRI is helping communities think about as the community starts to engage with how to reuse a property. And so the site's physical characteristics, what is the size of the property, what is the topographic relief of the site, does it have a lot of slopes, is it flat, what kind of hydrology does the site have? What are the physical characteristics of the site, independent of the contamination and remediation, that might tell us something about how this site might be reused? We want to look at site contamination and remediation characteristics, at least as far as they are known to EPA at the time that we're going through this exercise. And it's a common challenge with people. They frequently say, well, why don't we wait until EPA knows everything about the site? Because it takes a while for that to happen, and there are a lot of other factors that will influence a site's use that can really inform the direction that the property would go in. If you had a very small site with a large, with a significant amount of slope on the site, it doesn't really matter what the contamination is. It's probably not going to be suitable for uses that require, you know, ball fields that require large areas of flat land. So there's an awful lot that could be determined about the site's potential future use without even considering the contamination. But we do try to, through the process, really educate the public as much as possible about the contamination and the remediation. As well as, you know, the remediation status, what are the range of likely remedies at the site, and how long is that likely to take, so that they can be well informed in terms of time frames and thinking about when are we thinking about reusing this property and not just what are we thinking about using it for. We also help them. Oftentimes there's a need for SRI to help the community understand local land use regulations and considerations, look at adjacent land uses. Another big area, particularly at Superfund sites, is infrastructure. Fairly commonly, when SRI comes to a Superfund site, the local community is very, they associate the site often with jobs that were lost in the community, so they're often very interested in seeing that property redeveloped for industrial or economic purposes to create more jobs. Unfortunately, sometimes these properties might have enjoyed infrastructure that was beneficial to industry 50 or 60 years ago. They might be on a river, for example. But they don't necessarily enjoy the infrastructure that businesses and industry need today, like highway access. So helping them quickly look at how infrastructure and the availability of infrastructure to a property may significantly impact what the potential reasonably anticipated future land uses are. Can be very important. And oftentimes, and occasionally, sometimes market conditions is also an issue, although we generally try to take a more expedited look at market conditions because that tends less to be a driver in many cases than one might often think. So those are some of the areas of information support that EPA provides communities, but again, it all comes back to working with the community, helping them understand this information, working to give them the tools so they can be thinking about what are the reasonably anticipated future land uses. Next slide, which is slide 43, and I'm getting close to the end here. So the fourth step, as I outlined before, is creating a site reuse strategy that involves a conceptual reuse framework, you know, mapping out the site like I suggested on an earlier slide, creating zones of use, but then also kind of mapping out a strategy in terms of, you know, what might the sequence of events be here? What might need to happen first? Where is there an opportunity to reuse a portion of the site early, like in the Camilla, Georgia case I mentioned earlier, where part of the site's been cleaned up and it's already in reuse? Another part of the site might take another 4 or 5 years to get cleaned up, but that didn't preclude using part of the site. So that kind of a strategy and a framework for moving forward. And the fifth key step is looking at next steps and helping the community think about next steps. It's important to understand that statutorily, Superfund's responsibility is to protect human health and the environment, and that is how their resources need to be spent. The Superfund process is mindful and supportive of reuse, and SRI can provide lots of technical assistance. But statutorily, Superfund does not have money to spend directly on reuse or redevelopment activities. So the SRI process works closely with community groups to identify other potential sources of funding to support redevelopment. But perhaps more importantly, SRI works with the community groups to plan for how the community group will continue on as an entity and how they will continue to use what they have learned through the process to be contributing participants throughout the remedial process. So, you know, the support that SRI provides, you know, SRI is not able to be there continuously over a 5-year period. So what we try to do in creating the reuse, the community-based reuse plan is to map out kind of next steps for the community. What's the next point where they should be engaging in the process? How are they as a group going to function and continue on in order to support in order to get the reuse outcomes and engage in the process the way the community would like to. Next slide, please. So that's just a quick recap of the five major steps. Nothing real earth-shattering there, but you know, building the support, and then those steps two and three, that kind of opportunity for shared learning. And I want to emphasize, I didn't really mention this when I was talking before, because I talk a lot about how SRI is helping communities gain the tools that they need to be good participants in the process. But what we often find through this process is the community also often gives EPA and other regulators information and tools that they need to be good participants in the process. So it's a very collaborative process, and I think that most of the folks who have engaged in these processes would admit that every side learns something along the way that's very helpful in terms of thinking about the site moving forward. Next slide, please. So I'm on slide number 46, which is key considerations and lessons learned. And I had a real hard time with this because I think there are so many things that we've learned along the way. But on the next slide, I'll just briefly touch on a few things for folks to keep in mind. I can't emphasize this enough. Reuse planning at Superfund sites requires patience and a view towards long-term stewardship. The Superfund process is dealing with oftentimes extremely complicated hazardous waste issues, and they are trying to clean up problems that at times other folks have never had to deal with cleaning up, and it's very complicated. It can be a complicated process, and EPA works very hard and diligently to move that process along, but it is not always a fast process. And so communicating to communities and stakeholder groups that, you know, this is about your community for the long haul. There's not going to be a short answer here, but if you stick with this, there will be great benefits for the community over the long term. The second kind of key consideration is that reuse in the context of Superfund is very different than perhaps in the brownfield context. EPA's primary function, and in fact, their limited function within at a Superfund site is protecting human health and the environment. And so this reuse plays a very important role in helping to understand how to make better remedial decisions and ensuring long-term protectiveness. That is critically important and maybe in many ways as important as the reuse outcomes that result from the reuse planning. Third, is that reuse is considered in the framework, needs to be considered within the framework of private property rights and local authority to regulate land use. It often takes time to get people to understand why it is that a group of members of the public are getting together to plan for the reuse of private property. And so the best way I can explain this, and I think this is an important consideration, is that in most situations, land use situations, the public regulates land use, and local government serves that function and role through planning and zoning authority. And usually that regulation is trying to limit and keep developers from over-exploiting the property, from using the property for higher economic purposes, trying to put too much use on a piece of property, overcrowding a property, building office buildings where the community wouldn't want to see office buildings. In the context of Superfund, there can be a strange dynamic in which there is an incentive on the part of the current landowner to underdevelop the property. So if I were a landowner that had a contaminated piece of property and I were a responsible party and I was working with EPA, I might insist that the site was going to be used for, say, commercial industrial uses, and that's how I was going to use the property in the future, because that might keep the cost of my remedy very low or lower than it might otherwise be if it were to be cleaned up for a different use. So it's an unusual incentive where the landowner might have an incentive to insist that the land would be underutilized in order to keep their costs down, because the cost of cleaning up the property might far exceed the real estate value of the property. So in this case, the public has an important role to play to say, look, it's not realistic to think that that property is going to be developed for industrial purposes in the future. And if this landowner goes away and you clean it up to strictly an industrial purpose, we're left with a piece of property that really can't be used for that because it doesn't enjoy the right infrastructure, or it's located in a residential area, or a myriad of other reasons why that might not be the case. So there is this kind of important public role to digest the information and say, based on this information, we think this is the reasonably anticipated future land use. And that's a hard thing sometimes for folks to grasp. And again, some people are very mindful of the private property rights and not wanting to engage in that process. The fourth is what I've come to learn through this whole process is that considering reuse can create a framework for the entire community involvement effort at a site. And it can create a community involvement effort that moves beyond kind of a win-lose dynamic. If we are talking strictly about Superfund cleanup, the way I would describe it is there's a dynamic that can be created where EPA and the PRPs have to bear all the cost of cleanup at a site, but they don't have to live with any of the consequences. They don't live near the site. And the neighbors live near the site but don't have to pay for any of the cleanup. So there's a dynamic that's created where there's the potential, it's very hard for people maybe to feel like they've won, that somewhere along the line some compromise gets made where it's less clean or more clean than somebody feels that it should be. But if we start thinking about reuse, we create a different dynamic in which folks can be thinking about, well, if we get it to be this clean, we get a win out of this because we can get this type of use, and we can move forward as a community. It creates a lot of results. And I think it creates a very different dynamic for how communities and EPA and responsible parties and landowners can work together. And it can be a key to successful working relationships at Superfund.
Thank you, Mike. Mike will be around till the end of the session when we take questions. But for right now, I'd like to move on to Gary Riley, who's not only a remedial project manager, but he's also a Superfund Redevelopment Initiative coordinator. So Gary, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Melissa, and thanks, Mike, for setting the stage so well for this more specific example. Welcome, everyone. I'm joining, as Melissa said, from EPA's headquarters office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, where I'm on a temporary assignment. But I usually work in EPA's Pacific Southwest Regional Office in San Francisco. And I'm here to discuss an example of community-based reuse planning at one of our Superfund sites in Globe, Arizona, the Mountain View Mobile Home Estate site. And slide 48 is the initial slide. Moving on to slide 49. Here's a brief outline of what I'll talk about during this case study. First, I wanted to set the stage by emphasizing that those of us here in EPA Region 9 see the community's experience in this process as the big success of this story. For that reason, I want to talk about that first and then keep it in mind throughout the rest of the presentation. Then I'll step back and speak a bit about the site's background and physical context. Next, I'll talk about the community-based reuse assessment process as it was specifically applied at this site that you heard Mike introduce. It helped the community learn vital details about the site. And it led to a final product of a reuse assessment document that summarizes everything the community or any interested developer would need to know about this site. And then finally, I'll dig a bit deeper into that reuse assessment process and try to pinpoint exactly why it was such a success at the Mountain View site. And in closing, we'll talk about the next steps for the City of Globe. Next slide, please. This is slide 50. As we talk about Mountain View today, I'd like to focus on the community's experience in this process. Let's try to think about their perspective and involvement as a backdrop for all that we discuss. I think we can frame this perspective with three goals, shown here on the slide. In order to do something productive with this piece of the property, first, the community needed to better understand the site. Since this is a deleted National Priorities List Superfund site, we're not talking about a pristine greenfield of never developed property. The community knew they needed to keep in mind the unique characteristics of this site, but may not exactly have been sure how to digest the details of the cleanup and apply them to the plans they might envision. Second, the community needed to consider overall land use needs in the city. And third, the community had to put all of this information together and make an informed decision about what, if anything, they should do with this site. They were looking for a reasonable intersection of the site's developability and the city's development needs. In order to do all of these things, the city needed critical information that they didn't have on hand in an easy-to-understand format. In short, they needed to answer these two questions. What does the Mountain View site offer, and what does the community want and need? In other words, what were the characteristics of this piece of formerly contaminated, now cleaned up property? And what, if anything, did they, the community members, want to do with it? Let's step back for a moment and go over the background of this site, and then I'll return to these two community questions. Next slide, please. Slide 51. Until 1973, a mill structure located on the Mountain View site processed chrysotile asbestos, also called white asbestos, the most common form. The local air quality control district shut the mill down because the facility was not meeting air emission standards. Before this mill closed, the owners rezoned the property for residential use. Then they regraded the asbestos mill tailings, partially covered them with topsoil, and installed a mobile home community for 130 residents. In 1983, following detection of asbestos in the soil, EPA listed the site on the National Priorities List. The residents were relocated in 1985, and cleanup of the site began. The cleanup involved crushing and burying the mobile homes and structures into two natural depressions on the site, installing drainage culverts and enclosing the piping, placing a filter fabric over the site, layering clean soil over that fabric, and then adding a compacted and crushed rock cover to complete the cover. And finally, a fence was placed around the entire site. In 1988, EPA deleted the site from the MPL, and since that time, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality has been overseeing maintenance activities. Next slide, please. A bit more about the remedy. The filter fabric is covered with at least 24 inches of soil and 3 inches of gravel. Because the cap material covers the asbestos-containing soil and debris, the operation and maintenance plan lays out development restrictions that must be obeyed in order to prevent exposure to asbestos beneath the cap. Some of the most significant restrictions are listed on this slide. Any redevelopment plan must adhere to these restrictions and should keep in mind that disturbing the soil and gravel cap could add significant cost and complication to the project. Next slide, slide 53. Since 1988, when the site was deleted from the MPL, it has sat on the outskirts of the city, vacant and fenced off. The state of Arizona currently owns the site, and as I said earlier, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality oversees maintenance of the cap. The site itself appears as a relatively level area surrounded by steeper terrain. Anyone traveling on Highway 70 or Route 77 passes directly by the site. I'll talk more about the site's characteristics, surroundings, and geographic setting in a few minutes. Next slide. Without digging too far into those details, it's apparent from the outset that the Mountain View site offers a relatively large physical size, a good location, it has potential rail access, has a fairly low land price, and is currently zoned intermediate commercial. This zoning allows for retail sales, office buildings, and health services, but restricts all industrial uses. Because the site sits on the eastern outskirts of the city, it has no pre-existing water, sewer, or electrical infrastructure. There is, however, an on-site drainage system in place to prevent the cap from eroding. You can see a component of that here in this photo. As mentioned before, this site isn't an ordinary piece of property. Residents and city officials in Globe needed help in figuring out how to balance the positive attributes of this land with the potential complications of developing on a Superfund site. Next slide. Slide 55. Globe's residents and officials have known for a long time that there's very little light industrial property available in their city. If one were to look at a map and try to figure out how the city could expand its light industrial property base, they'd find that Globe is surrounded by state and federally owned lands. Since this Mountain View site could possibly fill in this gap, a number of people from the city worked with EPA to learn more about the possibilities for the site. These included the mayor, the Economic Development Department, the city manager, and city council representatives. Next slide, slide 56. In order to assist the city of Globe, EPA and the Superfund Revitalization Initiative funded a community-based reuse assessment for the Mountain View site. The purpose was to identify reasonably anticipated future land use and to better inform near-term planning at the site. Next slide. 57. The reuse assessment required considerable analysis of the site. In August 2008, a team of consultants to EPA's Superfund Revitalization Initiative visited the site to see it firsthand and meet with primary stakeholders from the City of GLO. Following that, the consultant team, the site's EPA remedial project manager, Andrea Benner, and EPA's Brownfields project manager, Nuria Muniz, worked with the stakeholders through the remainder of the process. Conducting this reuse assessment consisted of all the steps that you see listed on this slide. Next slide, Pete. 58. The reuse assessment provided a comprehensive description of the Mountain View site, including its physical, environmental, and developmental characteristics. I'll cover these in more detail later on. Next slide, please. Slide 59. The reuse assessment analyses also provided the city with answers to the questions on this slide. They're all questions that are vital to the decision-making process for reusing this site. Let's take a look at some of the assessment's findings in more detail, starting with the next slide, slide 60. On this zoning map of the City of GLO, purple represents general industrial districts. As you can see, there's very little that's available in this category. As mentioned earlier, there's no specifically light industrial property currently located within the city. Also of note on this figure is the large amount of green area to the right side of the figure. This is open space owned by either the state or federal government. You can see that this seriously restricts GLO's ability to expand. Next slide, slide 61. Again, you can notice from this aerial map how the City of GLO is uniquely confined by its surroundings. There's a lot of difficult to develop land because of its terrain or federal state ownership in the immediate surrounding area. And you can see that the Mountain View site, while not a huge land area, is still proportionally large compared to the total area of the city, and the site's outlined in red to the lower right quadrant of this figure. It's easy to see how, from a perspective of a stakeholder in GLOBE, that if this site turns out to be conducive to light industrial development, it could significantly help and expand the industrial land base in the city. Next slide, slide 62. Because this site was cleaned up rather long ago in the mid-1980s, the site maps and documents detailing levels of remaining contamination were not digitized, and much of the technical information was difficult to show in an easily understandable format. SRI's consultant team gathered the available information and put together a series of maps and diagrams to help stakeholders understand details of the site. One of those is the figure shown here. This map shows the distribution of asbestos-containing materials after construction of EPA's remedy. The orange circles show the depths at which asbestos remains present. Light orange circles represent shallower depths of contamination, and darker circles show asbestos present at deeper depths. These results are important in the event that a development activity would disturb the cap. Using this map, a potential developer can understand where it's more likely to encounter asbestos during excavation activities and at what depth. Next slide, slide 63. This figure shows the thickness of the cover that EPA constructed across the site. Light gray areas have a depth of cover of less than 3 feet. Brown areas have a depth of cover greater than 3 feet. As you can tell, deeper areas of the cover, again in the darker color, are discontinuous and ranged throughout the property. Next slide, slide 64. The figure here I think is really helpful because it combines the components of the remedy and restrictions associated with the remedy into one depiction. Some of the key features to note are the darker brown areas that indicate debris burial locations and the burial sites of the mill structure itself. Also, one can see the drainage feature of the site, which is located in blue. You can see that the site cover.
Yeah, can we just stop for 1 second? Somebody's typing in the background, and so I think you're probably not on mute. So could you please take care of that? Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa. And just as a reminder, some of the overall restrictions associated with the remedy that would affect development are excavation is currently not allowed below the fabric liner, again, which covers the light brown portion of this figure shows the cover, which extends basically over the entire site, and excavation is not allowed below this fabric liner. Footings or building foundations would only be allowed within or on top of the cover. Utilities are allowed only within or on top of this cover. Impervious areas have to include stormwater controls to minimize any potential erosion of the cover, and all engineering and institutional controls must remain in place. And seemingly needless to state, but very important, is that residential uses are not allowed at this site due to the remaining asbestos that's contained in place on the site. The next slide, slide 65. This map shows the site's grading. The lightest green areas have a slope of 0 to 3%, while the darkest green areas have a slope of greater than 5%. On the map here, you can quickly see that the flattest areas of the site are not that large. The mid-grade areas are isolated amongst the steepest areas of the site. So it's important information for a potential developer looking at a light industrial use to consider. Next slide, slide 66. Based on the information about the slope of the site, SRI's consultant team identified four possible building locations on the Mountain View site. The yellow development areas are contiguous areas with less than 5% slope. Within these areas, the team identified potential building footprints, which are contiguous areas with less than a 3% slope. You can see that the developable areas are fairly small compared to the area of the entire site, and the possible building footprints are even smaller. Next slide, slide 67. This figure shows how much of a setback would be required if the site were to be used for various industrial purposes. The intermediate commercial designation, shown in pink, has the smallest setback requirement. General industrial, dark purple, has the largest. Arrows show the potential access points to the site from existing roadways, down to the bottom of the slide. And the dotted line through the middle shows how the site could be connected to the existing railroad line that runs to the north of the site. The dashed outlines show the potential development areas that were shown on the previous slide. Next slide, slide 68. The participants in the community-based reuse assessment decided from the beginning that they wanted to avoid disturbing the remedy. EPA Region 9, Arizona DEQ, and the stakeholders from the City of Globe agreed that a future use scenario that required minimal to no remedy disturbance would minimize construction costs, construction management issues, and community concerns. The table shown here from the reuse assessment report lays out possible scenarios and details the relative construction costs, community regulatory processes, and market considerations associated with each. Next slide, slide 69. The primary goal of the reuse assessment process was to try to align what the constructed remedy could support with what the community wanted to do with this site. The reuse assessment document, the cover of which is pictured here, provides a summary of all the information that the City of Globe needed to know in order to decide whether they wanted to acquire and develop this site. Next slide. Slide 70. Based on the conclusions of the reuse assessment, the city has decided not to purchase and redevelop the site at this time. This decision is partly due to economic limitations and partly due to the city's new, more complete understanding of what a development project at the site might entail. Even though the City of Globe is not interested in pursuing acquisition at this time, not all is lost. The city could easily reevaluate its decision when economic conditions improve. In the meantime, all stakeholders, including the Arizona DEQ, have a much better understanding of what types of potential future uses the site and remedy could support. Arizona DEQ intends to use the reuse assessment as a primary educational tool if and when parties express interest in the site in the future. Those of us in Region 9 of EPA consider this outcome to be a significant success. It's true that the city or a developer are not breaking ground on a new development right now. Yet the dialogue about the site has been very successful from a community involvement and public participation perspective. On the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about the particulars that we think made this case a real success. Next slide, 71. It may seem a bit odd to linger on the success of a community-based reuse assessment that resulted in a city's decision not to do anything with the site. Consider more broadly, however, this is a positive outcome. The last thing we want is for anyone to embark on a Superfund site redevelopment project without knowing exactly what they're getting into and what development at the site would entail. In this case, the city started out planning to purchase the site and convert it into light industrial property. Once they learned more about what the site can actually support, and in the midst of current economic realities, they decided that their plan didn't make sense to pursue at this time. The reuse assessment document is still available and remains a very useful source of information for any potential developer, and it's always possible that the city or others would decide in the future that the time is right to go ahead with acquisition and redevelopment of the site. In the meantime, we feel that the City of Globe now has a more positive relationship with EPA, and the stakeholders who were involved in this process are appreciative of how open and inclusive the agency process has been. At EPA Region 9, we think this is a winning outcome for everyone. And the final slide has contact information, slide 72. And we take questions at the end of the session.
Melissa. Okay, great. Thank you, Gary. And now let's move on to Tom Bloom, who's, a remedial project manager and a Superfund redevelopment initiative coordinator.
Hi, Melissa, and everybody on board. I'd like to talk about the HOD case study. Next, slide 74, please. Okay, the HOD is located in Antioch, Illinois, which is right close to the border of Illinois and Wisconsin, about a couple of miles off of Lake Michigan. It's a site that was initially of 121 acres. It has a 51-acre landfill, and the remaining 70 acres are adjacent to the landfill. You can see in this figure that the landfill is divided into half. The western half is considered an old part of the landfill that's got about 10 to 15 feet of fill, and it's been covered a couple of times. And the part of the landfill up to the east, to the right, that yellow area, is a new part of the landfill, and that's 60 to 80 feet deep, still producing methane and still subsiding quite a bit. Adjacent to it is a wetlands to the south, a landfill borrow area to the northeast, and a wetlands and forested area to the northwest. From 63 to 84, it was a commingled landfill where municipal wastes went in. And now let's go to the next slide, 75. So prior to our record of decision in 98, the Illinois EPA put a clay cap on part of the landfill. When vinyl chloride was discovered on the northwestern portion of the landfill and flowing off the northwest portion of the landfill into the city's municipal well, 1998 record of decision called for restoring the eroded cap with more compressed clay, upgrading the gas and methane collection system. They put in a system where methane and gas are piped through the same piping system to a collection area, long-term groundwater monitoring, and implementation of institutional controls, and one of those had to do with a fence that was required to be put up for construction purposes, but later on kind of sent mixed messages to the community. Slide 76. So what happened was, thinking ahead, I believe the mayor might have gone to the waste management people. They were both co-owners of portions of the landfill. And the mayor of Antioch had an idea for a golf course, and he asked waste management if they could flush mount some of their stick-ups, some of their monitoring wells to kind of help with a possible golf course. That never came in, the plan for a golf course never came to fruition, but waste management was willing to do that. And so in their design phase, they came to us and asked for approval to put flush-mounted wells in. We looked at their designs and said, yeah, it sounds like it would still be protective. And that kind of, and the landfill was fairly flat on the top, so that kind of helped when we were thinking about a potential recreational use. Slide 77. So the main thing that came out of it was actually the athletic fields for the high school. Right next to the landfill, the high school was landlocked, and their athletes had to be bused to different athletic fields to practice. And the school superintendent talked to me and talked to Waste Management's closed site section person and asked, could we use part of the landfill or part of the area adjacent to the landfill for practice fields for our football players? And at first we thought about it and we said, we could still be protective and all, and we've got flush-mounted wells that would allow for recreational uses. But, there was a big concern there locally as far as a stigma concern. A lot of people had felt that there was methyl ethyl death buried there and didn't want their kids playing football, soccer, or anything on the landfill. Then what came out of another issue that kind of came out was, well, there was methane still being generated and flared, and the school superintendent had an idea, well, why can't we use that methane to heat our school and maybe produce some electricity for our school? And we kind of looked at that idea with waste management, too, initially. And then talking about the wetlands around the site, we were thinking about an educational opportunity for the school to go out and look at wetland habitat and all. So that were some of the initial reuse possibilities that we kind of came up with. Slide 76. So what could possibly go wrong? Well, a lot of things go wrong when you try to collaborate with people that have different agendas. But if you can convince everybody that a certain part of their agenda can be addressed through compromise and that everybody could come together for a common goal, it seems like it takes a while, but yes, you can move forward and have things work. So let's go to slide 79. Like I said earlier, one of the major concerns was the site's stigma. We held public meetings and people came to the meetings and said, I won't let my kids play on this soccer field unless it's 110% safe. And somebody else in the public meeting would get up and say, ma'am, it wasn't 110% safe for you to drive to this meeting. But that was one of the things that we had to overcome, was that we could still be protective and allow children to recreate on top of this landfill. And some of the things that we used were as-built or true-to-life graphics that showed 3 feet of compressed clay with a person standing on top of it. And at these public meetings, I explained to the people that, you know, your child would have to dig through 3 feet of compressed clay to ever get close to the solid waste that was down underneath it. And we wouldn't allow, that wouldn't be allowed to happen even if we did use it for recreational purposes. Some of the other things had to do with institutional controls. Like I said, it has to, the institutional controls required a site fence with barbed wire, and here we were saying, well, we think that the site could be used for recreational purposes, but then the public was saying, why do you have a high fence with barbed wire and warning signs if you think the site could be used for recreational purposes? And another challenge was, you know, coordination between the Village of Antioch, Antioch Township, and the school district. Like I said, each one had kind of a separate idea of what could be used, what the site could be used for, and a golf course, recreational fields, possibly some parkland. But for the most part, everybody was on board with some form of recreational type of a use. And for the funding for the reuse process, that was, you know, we provided the in-kind services of Ecology and Economics. That's our reuse consultant. But then we also needed money if we were going to, you know, construct a methane generation plant through a grant process. We needed, you know, I think that Waste Management was able to get to some other responsible parties and get some buy-in and some financial support from them. That comes up later on in some of the next slides. So let's go to slide 80 right now. Key stakeholders that we identified were the high school, the Village of Antioch, the township, Waste Management's closed group, EPA, and the local community. We had talked to a lot of people in the area, and it's one part of the reuse process and the stakeholder involvement is to get a good diversity of different stakeholders out there. Not everybody in the neighborhood got along with each other, so when you'd say, do we need to include the people from the that want to play soccer, you know, the people that wanted the fields for softball would say no. So it's very important to, you know, try to get a good diverse group of stakeholders out there and then maybe try to convince them that each of their agendas can be addressed if they all come together and work on a common goal. And maybe you can't get 100% of your agenda addressed, but you could, through compromise, get 50% of your agenda addressed, and everybody feels good once you reach that goal. And that's kind of what we were trying to set up there with the stakeholders in the community around Antioch. Slide 81. So, like I said, you know, to address some of the stigmas, we held multiple meetings. We had toxicologists talk to them. I think we might have even shut down the methane system for a couple of days to see if it would go positive, which it didn't, to convince one of our toxicologists that if there was a catastrophic failure, that you wouldn't have methane flowing out of the landfill and kids inhaling it while they were playing soccer on top. And we also kind of identified that, you know, this fence with the barbed wire was kind of a barrier out there, that, you know, telling people it would be safe to use but having warning signs and barbed wire on the fence was kind of like a contradicting what we were saying. Certainly a fence could be available in the park district that was going to run the recreational fields wanted a fence, but it didn't need to have barbed wire and warning signs. And the only reason it was in institutional controls was for during remedial action construction. But it didn't say in institutional controls when remedial action construction is complete, you can take the fence down or modify the fence or take off the warning signs and all like that. So that was one of the barriers that we kind of identified right up front. Slide 82. One of the ways that we addressed the site stigma was to put a ready for reuse determination document, which I think Gary or Mike might have mentioned one earlier. And basically, these are environmental condition reports, or reports on the environmental condition of the site. It's like written in layman's terms with not a lot of legalese. It's not a legal document. But it just says that basically that EPA has found the site is available and ready for recreational use. It has some disclaimers in it saying that it's not a legal document. And it also has some information in it that tells you what can and what can't be done out there as far as institutional controls. And that seemed to help quite a bit with getting, you know, local people more interested and feeling a little bit more warm and fuzzy about letting their kids recreate on top of the site. Slide 83. So here we see a picture of, you know, a fence modification and how we were putting in some of the fencing for backstops for the softball fields, where we wouldn't dig too far into the clay cap. We would put, instead of going through with a narrow hole, we were putting in wide, flat support systems. And I ended up eventually writing an explanation of significant differences that modified the institutional controls that said we didn't need a fence with barbed wire and warning signs, but we wanted that we would still require waste management and the people that were taking care of the site for long-term operation and maintenance to move the fence and put a smaller fence around the operation and maintenance area, and then to lock the flush-mounted wells so that none of the kids could goof around and get into the flush-mounted wells and open up, you know, look and see what's inside, because we knew the general public would be allowed on the site. Slide 84. Here's my slide that talks about the ESD, that explanation of significant differences. We've modified the chain link fence. I just spoke ahead of myself, but you can see here that we're, you know, modifying it to allow fencing around the operation and maintenance areas and securing of the equipment outside of the operation and maintenance areas. Slide 85. Well, here's a slide that shows numerous meetings that we had there to help with the stigma, to get the buy-in of the community, to get to kind of capacity build with the community to let them know that, you know, we felt that they are children could be safe and protective and still use the site for recreational purposes. Slide 86. Here's a slide that shows how we got some of the funding. I mentioned it earlier that Waste Management donated some money for the project. They donated $100,000 to the school for a watering system. But they were smart about it, and they put in, they wanted, one of the stipulations of their donation was that they wanted moisture sensors in the water system so that they didn't create more leachate in their landfill, and they would only water the grass enough to keep it green but not to create leachate, which I thought was a pretty good idea. Some of the non-selling PRPs contributed too. I think we had some Navy guys out there building boardwalks in the wetlands. We were able to get a grant to build a cold gen system. And we have EPA SRI program has a partnership with the U.S. Soccer Foundation, and they were able to help with some of the field designs and backstops and bleachers and goals and soccer goals and things like that. Slide 87. Here's what it looked like before with a, you know, very sparse vegetated cover on the landfill. And here's what the borrow area looks like now as of like last Earth Day, where we've dedicated the Tim Osman Sports Complex, which will have, I believe, several softball fields, a disc golf course, a playground. I think they're talking about a sledding hill out there. This was put up in the borrow area after we did the initial recreational reuse on the old part of the landfill, and that slide's going to come up next on slide number 89. That's what we called McMillan Park. So you're seeing some of the tennis courts are out there, the softball fields are out there. A couple of neat things were we put in restrooms for around the concession area, and then instead of there was an infrastructure for the restrooms, so waste management was allowed us to design a system so that the restroom discharge would go into their leachate collection tank. And therefore, we didn't have to put a leach field in or around the landfill. And then when the leachate gets weak enough, the mayor's going to take the leachate at his POTW. Right now, they're still trucking it off every couple of months. Clean Harbors is taking it off site. So there's, collaboration all along the way from the PRPs to the community and EPA involved in this case study. Next slide is number 90. Now the cogeneration plant comes in, and this is really neat. RMP designed it. We got some money to build it. It basically has two parts to it. It's got a building that's on the landfill in the maintenance area, and that's what you're looking at right now, the sign and the building in the maintenance area. And what they do there is we collect the methane and we compress it and scrub it and chill it, so we get all the phthalates and all the impurities out of it, and then the methane goes via pipeline about a mile and a half to the east under Sequoia Creek under the railroad tracks to another maintenance shed to another maintenance shed where that houses the cogeneration plant. And in that cogeneration plant are, I think, 13 cantaloupe-sized microturbines that spin on air, and they create electricity, and the heat and the electricity goes into the school's electrical grid, and what extra is left over, they sell to Commonwealth Edison, the local power company, and the heat that's generated it also goes into the school's boiler unit and heats the school. And a couple of months ago, I heard when we had a bad storm, and all the lights went out in Antioch. This is the only place generating electricity, and they helped, with heating, and with lighting City Hall, the police station, and some of the emergency buildings that they needed to get electricity to before they got the major grid up and running. It also, this cogeneration plant affords a lot of educational opportunities for the school. They have a physics, they have a chemistry curriculum that takes a look at what's going on there. And they also have, I think the kids are doing some environmental data monitoring where they go and they monitor the methane collection system and some of the generation of electricity that comes out of the cogeneration plant. So it's kind of a catch-all for a good science teacher picked up on it, and he's got the kids out there every semester checking out and monitoring the environmental data that comes out of the landfill. Slide 91. And here's the timeline. It didn't take just a six-month period to do this. It took quite a while for everything to come together. But we've been having some real nice success events, successful media events out there. Last year, I briefed and took out the head of the environmental department for India, the head of the environmental department for Spain, a couple of students from the Aravad Institute, which is an institute in the Middle East that helps Israeli and Arabic students tackle some of their environmental problems in the Middle East. So it's, once it came together, it's been quite a showcase to show how this collaborative effort can come together. Next slide, 92. And so here were some of the lessons that we learned there is, you know, basically let's listen to the community because they're going to be the ones who are going to be using the product when we're done with it, and we want to make sure that we do it in a way that it's not a closed loop and that we have community buy-in. This also helps with long-term stewardship. Kids were breaking into there and driving their all-terrain vehicles all over the landfill prior to this, even though we had a fence with barbed wire around it. Now it doesn't happen because everybody's taking a look at that park and everybody has kind of ownership about that park. And I shouldn't say it doesn't happen. When it does happen, they catch them quick, and they get in trouble where before they just get away with it all the time. You know, this also shows that, you know, reuse and operation maintenance can go hand in hand. One of the things here was that about halfway through the process, EPA's reuse program was doing all the work, and everybody else is kind of sitting back letting us do the work. And we had to figure out, well, we need a champion to come forward. And that ended up being the school superintendent. He kind of took the lead on moving forward with the grant for the cogeneration plant and also moving forward with the recreational fields and working with Waste Management's closed site division. So I think that's about it. Slide 93. And that's the end of my talk.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Why don't we go ahead and get to some of these questions that have come in. I think what I'll do is I'll read them and then we'll figure out who should answer them. How about that? So not necessarily in order, but I guess one question is, what percentage of NPL sites have been subject to the SRI process? I would say since we usually say we have about 500 sites in reuse and we have 1,750 sites on the NPL, somewhere near, not quite a third. We're always finding out about some new sites that are going into reuse, and I anticipate that that number will grow because when we first started this 10 years ago, people said, what? You're doing what? And now we like to think we're much more mainstream. So, yeah, Gary, you want to add to that?
And I was going to say, from the remedial project manager at EPA perspective, you know, the people who kind of manage these cleanups on a day-to-day basis, I think there's probably a lot of future land use assessment and reuse planning that's sort of going on as part of the day-to-day work of bringing these sites along through the Superfund pipeline that may not get highlighted in this perspective from headquarters. But I think, as Melissa suggests, with the number of sites that are in reuse, I would say a significant proportion of them that reuse didn't just happen. In other words, that there were some activities and no doubt probably considerations by EPA that allowed us to remove barriers to that reuse that aren't needed for protection of human health and the environment. So,
I'm going to read this next question. It's actually a two-parter. It's a little long, and I'm going to ask everybody to sort of chime in on the answer. Somebody's written in that they currently have a community advisory group, otherwise known as a CAG, that's very interested in the reuse aspects of cleanup. And right now, the RPM is putting together the work plan for the RIFS. So the question is, how can SRI work with the CAG, and has SRI ever worked with a CAG? And then following up, the CAG also has a technical assistance support contract as part of that. Gary, can you get me the rest of that question, please?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so the CAG also has a task, which has already completed a reuse assessment. So would SRI still have something to look at, I guess is the idea. We're having a little bit of technical trouble here. Has a reuse assessment completed by an outside consultant? So let's try to break this question down. I guess, Mike, I don't know if maybe we should call on you about, have you worked with CAGs during SRI planning? Mike? No, okay, we lost Mike. I guess the answer to this question is that we're happy to work with any groups that are out there. I can't specifically come up with a site that has one. But,
yes, we've got one, Melissa. The Belsicle site.
Yeah, can you think of some names of some of them?
Yeah, Belsicle site, we worked with CAG as a stakeholder.
Okay,
and,
good.
Mm-hmm.
So, Melissa, right, this is
Melissa, this is Mike. I'm sorry. I had myself on mute and I forgot.
Okay.
There have been a number of sites where we worked with CAGs where the CAG became a member of the planning group because the CAG did not necessarily represent all perspectives in the community related to reuse. So we worked with CAGs, but sometimes the CAG has then become a participant in a reuse planning committee that included a larger group of folks.
Okay, and what about TASC?
To answer this question in the straightest way, the TASC program at EPA headquarters is supported by the same contractor as the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. And the folks who did the reuse assessment under the TASC contract would essentially might very well be the same people who would do the reuse assessment under the SRI program. So I think that the site has had the SRI experience just funded through a different office.
Okay, that's great. And then what I would add to that question is if you're someone in an EPA region interested in reuse, I think the first person you would want to contact would be your regional Superfund Redevelopment Initiative coordinator. So in region, we know who all of them are and you can call us, but for region 3, it happens to be Chris Corbett. So I think we have another question down there, Gary. Can you scroll? How does EPA decide which sites are appropriate for the SRI process? In a sense, every site is appropriate because every site is involved in trying to determine what the reasonably anticipated future land use issue is. I guess beyond that, we and others may want to speak to this. We do have resources to offer at headquarters to help you pursue Superfund redevelopment to help you pursue that process. And some people have taken advantage of it and some people just do not. There are also a certain number of sites that have just, if you will, sort of have happened on their own because they're in such favorable surroundings or the economy's just been wonderful or they're what we sort of call low-hanging fruit. But at this point in the program, I don't think there are too many low-hanging fruit sites available. So we have to kind of think more broadly about what kinds of things can happen at a site. And we're also taking a much larger look at what I would call sort of not, we don't necessarily want a big box store or some kind of big shopping center or something like that. We're very interested in ecological and recreational and other kinds of opportunities. Do you guys want to add anything to that, Mike or Tom or Gary?
Yeah. There's also other sites other than just NPL sites. I mean, we have removal sites that come into our radar screen. We have non-time critical removals. We have the alternative sites. So as far as, when you're thinking about how many sites are in use and compared to how many are in the NPL, if you look at the whole universe, you might find out that it's a better ratio than just comparing it to NPL reuse sites.
Good point. Mike or Gary, you want to add something?
I guess I'd add, this is Gary, that through, for example, the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webpage that can be reached from EPA's Superfund homepage, that there are a number of success stories and sort of snapshots, including the Mountain View mobile home estate site that I spoke about in Arizona, that I think gets at the goal of SRI over its 10-year history and going forward is to show examples of success and how processes work so that we can duplicate that elsewhere and apply those principles as broadly as possible.
Okay. Let me just take a minute. We don't have any written questions up now, but I want to make sure that there are people on the phone who'd like to ask questions.
If you've muted your phone lines, if you simply press *6, you can unmute your phone line to ask the question vocally.
So if someone would like to ask a question, we're happy to take it. Okay. We're also all available after this. You can email us, and we're happy to talk with you more about what we talked about today or some other aspect of Superfund redevelopment. Would you just scroll through there and make sure we don't have an added question at the end if we've gone through all of them? Yeah, okay. So we don't have any questions pending, so if there are no more questions, I think we're pretty much done. I want to thank my panel, and I want to thank our technical support, and remind you that we do have another webinar coming up in July on ecological revitalization. So if there are no more questions, thank you, everybody, and we'll talk to you soon. I hope we'll see you next time.